Welcome to Keith and I Don't Tread on Anyone in the Libertarian Institute. Today, I am joined by Johan Norberg to discuss his new book, The Capitalist Manifesto. Mr. Norberg, where is the best place for people to purchase this book?
Well, actually, anywhere online would be a good place, I'm sure. So I think Amazon is fairly quick in sending out shipments now.
The subtitle is Why the Global Free Market Will Save the World. What is free market capitalism?
It's actually nothing more abstract and strange than the economic aspect of individual freedom. When people are free to go about their business and choose how to act, how to behave, whom to associate with, and what to do with their lives, that's freedom. And when we do this in the economic sphere, mostly associated with what kind of occupation we choose, whether we want to start businesses or not, how to save our money, whom to trade with and do business with, that's economic freedom. That's capitalism.
There seems to be a huge dichotomy. Almost everyone I speak to will say, oh yeah, sure, religious freedom is fine. You could have whatever religion you want, even if it's to your own detriment, even if you waste your entire life believing something that's false, so long as you don't force others to either fund your religion or join it. You can always persuade people. However, they have almost the complete opposite position when it comes to economic freedom. When you were doing research for this book, do you see why this dichotomy exists in the minds of so many people?
Well, yeah, I noticed that in so many places as well. People, theoretically, they like freedom and they like it in different spheres, but somehow it gets complicated the moment we start to talk about exchange, whenever we talk about money or something like that. And the impression I get when I talk to people is that they think about religious freedom and other kinds of personal liberties like that as something that's, it's all about yourself. It's how you choose to live your own life. It doesn't really affect others, though it does, but less so than acting in the economic sphere. And that's true. The actions we do on a market, they always involve somebody else because we do business, we trade, we exchange. Somebody else is involved. And to me, that's the best part of it, because in a free market, then no deal ever happens unless both parties think that they both benefit from it. Otherwise, they would walk away. So whenever you affect others, it is by offering something that they wouldn't have otherwise. It might be your time, it might be goods, services, technological capacities, or funding, or what have you. Whatever it is, it's an offer to improve somebody else's life or not. So that's, I think this is why it gets complicated. But to me, this is an extra argument for economic freedom.
I love the way you describe that, because so often the free market is seen as every man for himself, dog-eat-dog competition. Like, this completely complex network of millions of people exchanging is described as every man for himself, Robinson Crusoe style, which is so bizarre, the fact that that ever took hold. I want to look at the Communist Manifesto. Tell me what is wrong, if anything, with this. On page 17, by bourgeoisie, is meant the class of modern capitalists, owners of the means of social production and employers of wage labor, by proletariat, the class of modern wage laborers, who, having no means of production of their own, are reduced to selling their labor power in order to live. Capitalism's immoral because people have to work to live. Communism's moral because it gives people what they need to live, regardless of whether they are forced to work. How do you respond?
Well, the question is, if you don't have to work for your wealth, where does it come from? This is built on some sort of idea that, sorry, that's the cat all over again. My very libertarian cat, so she does whatever she wants and never listens to me. But capital doesn't just exist out there. It's something you create. Capital is capital goods, it's machinery, it's funds that you use to invest and build something new. It doesn't come from out of the blue. It's something that we all create. And if you say that someone is going to be able to live without working, that's somehow degrading to do something for others in order to earn an income or capital, then it means that somebody else is going to have to work for you. So it really means a system of enforced labor. And that's really what the ideas of Marx and Engels led to when they said that we'll find another less degrading way of creating wealth than having to find the places in the economy where we do the best good services to others and exchange with others voluntarily. Well, then they ended up with forcing people to move to certain areas of the economy to do certain services for the government instead.
One final note on the manifesto. When, therefore, capital is converted into common property, into the property of all members of society, personal property is not, therefore, transformed into social property. It is only the social character of the property that is changed. It loses its class character. Why isn't it better if everyone votes on how capital is accumulated and, you know, used, more or less, as opposed to there being a bourgeoisie and having things privatized?
Yeah. Well, the difference is that when we're talking about, it sounds great, we're all in charge of our resources and of our wealth rather than certain individuals. But what that actually means is that it's a much less democratic system than the free market economy, because the free market economy is based on the idea that millions and millions of people are allowed to choose how to live their lives, how to work, in which kinds of professions, what businesses to start, and then to try to engage with others and see if they can do enough services to them so that they will hand them something in exchange for it. And that's how we all have a stake in the system. And we're all involved in constantly trying to come up with better ways of servicing others. When we're putting this in the hands of the government, which is really what it is, it's not all of us, then we suddenly lose that direct link to between capital, wealth, and the services that we offer others. Instead, it's a tiny group of people. Usually, we can, of course, we can have voters voting on this, but in the end, it's the government, it's the bureaucrats. They get to decide where this will end up. And we've tried that in so many ways. What happens is that we'll still have competition for resources. We will still have people who are greedy. We still have people who are interested in wealth. And then they will get their hands on this property, but not by doing good services for others. They will do it by having political connections. They will end up with having their lobbyists and their the massive wealth that they've already attained in trying to divert those resources into their own pockets. That's what happens when the government's getting involved.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of, you know, my favorite books that exist, my favorite shows, my favorite pieces of technology. None of these came about as the result of a mass democratic vote. It was always a few private organizations competing for our voluntarily funded dollars. It seems like almost everything, even the things that the socialists love so much, all of these are the result of private enterprise and only a few people having a very big say and then competing voluntarily. When it comes to wealth that is created by democracy, am I missing something here? I just think this is a terrible idea all around.
Now, this is an incredibly important point, because even if we had a non-filtered, perfect direct democracy which decides where the funds will end up, what to do with the property, it's a terrible idea, exactly for the reasons that you mentioned. That's not where innovation comes from. I've studied the history of innovations for many years, and what I've found is that all great inventions, everything that we love today, from books to digital technology, umbrellas to cars to the personal computer, they are never the result of a political committee. None of these interventions came about because of a political committee, and neither do they come about from one single genius who just sort of, let's invent something great. It came about by millions of people experimenting and facing lots of feedback from users, from the market, from competitors, lots of trial and errors, lots of failed experiments, and then adaptations and new experiments, and then they end up with something great. And often they are the only ones who believe in it, these eccentrics who keep on incremental progress and these experiments all the time. And if these crazy people in garages had nothing but a single big committee run by the whole world's population and a majority vote, we would not have the internet, we would not have smartphones, we would not have bicycles, we would not have the umbrella, we would not have anything that we now cherish, because originally they were seen as the title of one of the best management books that I've read, they were always seen as worthless, impossible, or stupid, or all of them. And it was only because they could find some consumers who were interested, only because there was a diverse networks and ecosystem of different funders, venture capital, stock markets, different banks, and so on, that they could find someone who believed in it so that they could continue to experiment until we all realized that this is a great idea.
When it comes to mass production of goods that increases the standard of living of the average person, we frequently hear that, well, when things are privatized, only the rich can afford them. What is it about capitalism that allows products and services over time to both increase in quality and increase in their accessibility to the average person? I'm thinking of cameras by people like George Eastman did not invent the camera, but he made it much more available. Henry Ford did not invent the car, but he made it much more accessible to people. Same thing with Vanderbilt and the steamships. Is this a feature of capitalism, or could the state take this over and do just as good a job in healthcare and housing?
Well, I think we can look at the empirical data. What is it that comes down in price? Well, everything that's traded on a market. And what is that that has over the long period of time, over a longer period of time? What is it that stays costly or increases in price? Well, everything that the government is involved with, basically. And this is because of the basic incentive of capitalism. The elite is small. That's why it's called the elite. And if you only produce for them, you won't make much money. The low and middle income households, there are many more of them. And if you can continue to turn what used to be luxury goods for the elites into routine manufacturing for the poor, then you will make tons of profits as well. It was Joseph Schumpeter, the Austrian economist, who said that, you know, Queen Elizabeth in the 17th and late 16th century, she had silk stockings and she could afford cotton clothes. And that's not what's new with capitalism. The new thing with capitalism is that you come up with methods and better production and new ideas to make sure that even factory girls could have stockings as well, and many pairs of them as well, because that's how you make a fortune in the long run. But that's all dependent on this competition from lots of different entrants into the market who continue to come up with even weirder ideas on how to make things come down in price over time.
It seems like incentives is one of those areas that only one group really focuses on. It seems like the free market people talk about incentives, whereas everyone else talks about what are human rights that everyone should have. Incentives are things that could come and go based on culture. What are incentives and why are they important?
Well, incentives, that's really, you know, it's the GPS of the economy. It's what tells us where to go if we want to end up where we want to be. So the price system is a combination. It's the signal of, it's really a flag waving. There's something people want over here. There's a shortage or there's suddenly an increased demand to do something. But it's also an incentive because it tells you that if you can satisfy this demand, you'll make money. So it's really the best form of signaling flag, one that tells you both that something is needed and that you will make money if you go there. And that's why incentives are, are so incredibly important, because we can always talk about needs and wants and what have you, but that doesn't spur action. And in a political process, that's not necessarily what happens, because you have ideological preferences. You have, as we've been taught by the public choice school, individual interests of even the bureaucrats and the politicians and the voters that might lead them to do something else than actually satisfying the real needs. But incentives, that's an honest feedback from people who are willing to risk their own money to get something done. And it spurs action from whomever is best qualified to satisfy it. So that's why, if you want something done, put an incentive on it.
I want to take a look at Communist Manifesto Twitter. Tell me what, if anything, is wrong with the logic of this post. This woman says, "I had to go to Walmart. They've put locks on all of the cooking oil. This country is doomed. If you support capitalism at this point, you're a death cultist. I'm tired of playing nice." And then she has a picture of canola oil and vegetable oil tied so people will not steal them. What, if anything, is wrong about the thought process of what is going on here in this tweet?
Well, I'm not sure really what she's getting at. Could be two things, that oil is such a basic necessity that we should be allowed to get it for free, which in case would be the best way of ending all the production of cooking oil instantly. That's what happened when you have a price controls on things. People stop producing that particular thing. Or it could be a way of saying that we're now so desperately poor that we can't afford it and people start stealing it. That's where we've ended up after decades and decades of free markets. I would challenge that. We live in relatively market-based societies. We live in the richest societies that have ever existed. There's a myth of wage stagnation going on, but if you include total compensation in the US, we've seen an increase in incomes of some 60% since 1990. And lots of this comes from not just the everyday functioning of capitalism and increased productivity, but also free trade and the ability to buy from competitors in other places. The reason why they lock up stuff is that, yes, some of it is being stolen, and specifically when you have these kinds of goods that are relatively easy to trade on the market. You know what it is. It's single, simple packaging, and you'll get it there. It's not that people steal bulky, difficult things that are important to their lives. It's that they buy things that they can sell on the black market.
I was very surprised looking through the Human Freedom Index of 2023. If all I did was listen to Bernie Sanders, I would assume that number one is obviously America, total freedom, almost no regulations, and close to the bottom, you would have places like Sweden, which are democratic socialists. To my surprise, all of the Nordic countries rank higher on the Human Freedom Index than the United States and the United Kingdom. What is it about Sweden that is more free market than America?
Well, it's complicated because there are issues on which America is more free market. There's less public spending, and there are overall lower taxes in the U.S. than in Sweden, though not the difference is not as big as it used to be once upon a time. But there are also other areas of the economy and regulations generally. Of businesses and people, on trade across borders and stuff like that, where Sweden is doing fairly well and other Nordic countries are doing fairly well as well. If Bernie Sanders want to imitate Sweden, he would have to reform Social Security with partial privatization. He would need to introduce school voucher system. He would have to reduce corporate taxes and abolish taxes on wealth, property, inheritance, and gifts. He would have to abolish occupational licensing, no minimum wage, stuff like that. So it's complicated. The economy is a big thing, and you can implement regulations on many different places. And compared to lots of other countries, Scandinavian countries have at least been fairly good at keeping product markets and trade open compared to others. Then the Human Freedom Index is even more complicated because it includes personal freedoms in lots of different areas, and religious freedom and free speech and so on. And Nordic countries seem to be doing fairly well over there.
On page 21, you say, taking control of capitalism actually means that governments take control of citizens. Walk us through what that means.
Yeah, economic freedom is not freedom for the economy. It sounds like it. It sounds like there's some specific entity over there that gets a lot of freedom, but it's not. It's just individual freedom, but applied to the economic sphere. What we do when we work, when we produce, when we save, when we invest, and when we barter and exchange with others. So it's what we do. It's our individual creativity based on our own individual needs and interests and our local knowledge. And when people talk about restricting this, it sounds like they're restricting this strange entity over there, capitalism or the economy. It's not. They are restricting what we are allowed to do with our time and with our creativity. And therefore, it's not something dignified. It's really a way of controlling aspects of our lives.
On page 68, you say capitalism is morally superior to socialism. How do you measure that? And what is your case that it's actually morally superior to socialism?
Well, look no further than all the other alternatives, or the alternatives to capitalism that have been tried from time to time. This is the first economic system that's not a system imposed from the top, but based on our own freedom to go about our business in our own way. Every previous system and every existing alternative system now, be it slavery or feudalism or communism or fascism, that's based on one group being in charge and stealing the time, life, and freedom of others, extracting resources from people who would want to do something else instead. Capitalism, free market capitalism, is based on the opposite idea. The first system where you're allowed to say, no, I don't agree with that, I will go somewhere else. Deals only happen if both parties to the agreement think that they will be better off afterwards than they were before they entered into it. So it's the first system that really recognizes our individual dignity and the fact that we are separate individuals with different interests and that we should be allowed to pursue those interests and those dreams rather than just being the tools in some big machinery.
What do you think more accurately reflects dog-eat-dog competition, the democratic process of voting and politicians running, or the free market where businesses compete?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it always seems like we're so dignified when we go into the voting booth and think about the long-term interests for everyone. I think people are getting around to the idea that that's not always the way it works, right? Rather, it reveals some of our tribal instincts and some of our group warfare, because we're actually fighting over a fixed pie when it comes to politics. We have a certain amount of wealth, and then it's up to the politicians to divide to whom should go the spoils. And in that case, it turns us into enemies of one another. It turns us into different tribes, and you have to belong to one of them, because otherwise your pockets will be picked by somebody else and your liberties will be trampled upon by somebody else. So suddenly everybody feels like they have to belong to a group, to a collective, and fight against the others. That's dog eat dog, because you fight over the fixed amount of dog food. Capitalism is something entirely different. It sounds like we are fighting over limited resources there as well, because resources are always limited. But the way in which we get resources in a free market is that you offer the people who own the resources that you want something that they want even more than those resources, so that they will give them to you voluntarily. So it means that suddenly I have to take the interests of everybody else into account. That's what happens, not at the voting booth, but it happens in the marketplace. Because suddenly I have to think about, what do the others want? What kind of goods and services are they interested in? If there's some place in the economy, something I can do some work on, or start a business model to work on, that would make them even happier. And so even more interested in handing the resources that I want over to me than something else. So that's not dog eat dog. That's win-win.
I love that point about how it turns people against each other. Because right now, you don't get too much, you know, of having people in America violently impose their religion on one another. But if the state was going to regulate religion and make sure we all had the correct religion and the most productive one, well, then I can't just sit by and be a Scientologist while you're a Jehovah's Witness. If I don't violently dominate you, you're going to violently dominate me. So now it's turned into dog eat dog because of state intervention.
Yeah, and that's awful, because it really brings out the worst in human nature and speaks to our tribal mindset. You know, otherwise, on the market and civil society, as long as I act in a voluntary way, in exchange with people in a voluntary way, I find common interests in so many different places. I mean, I love books, and I love people who love books, even if they read other books than I do. We share this interest, and we talk about it, and we give each other recommendations and so on. But if the government suddenly decided on which kinds of books will be produced, we've now taken control of the printing presses, and we will only produce good, healthy, virtuous books in the future. Well, then suddenly, people who love other books than I do are suddenly my enemies, because if they get the majority, they will just produce, I don't know, romance and crime stories, rather than dignified classical drama and libertarian economics. And in that case, I have to then associate and build the group and fight against the others over who will get to decide. So it's politics is a dangerous thing.
Who was Deng Xiaoping, and what are some things we can learn from him?
Oh, yeah. Deng Xiaoping was a brutal dictator in China in the late 1970s and the 1980s. But his best trait was that he was not Mao Zedong, the even much more brutal communist dictator of China for a very long period of time. And under Deng Xiaoping, something remarkable happened. China, that had been a brutally planned economy that starved its citizens and created extreme poverty at unprecedented levels, began to liberate its economy and grow faster than most other countries over 30 years. And this wasn't planned by Deng Xiaoping. It wasn't conceived by him. It was something that surprised him when he saw this happening in China in the late 1970s, how people fed up with the old system that led to hunger and misery, they began to, farmers in small villages started to secretly privatize land so that they would be able to have the freedom to produce and work as much as they wanted with the kind of crops they chose and got to keep the rewards. They started to secret village businesses, and then kids in the cities demanded the same kind of rights. When Deng Xiaoping saw this, and this was his great achievement, he didn't put them in jail, as communist orthodoxy would have it. But instead he said, I don't like this sort of grassroots capitalism that's going on here, but it seems like it's better than starving. So he actually put an official stamp of approval on these behavior and allowed businesses to start to experiment with this in certain export processing zones, even with foreign capital and foreign trade and so on. And this is really the start of the Chinese miracle in the 1980s, 90s, and the early 2000s, which might have brought some 700 million Chinese out of poverty.
What raises living standards and how can they be measured?
Yeah, it's complex because really we have to look at lots of different indicators of well-being. And there are plenty. It's health, it's child mortality, it's life expectancy, it's access to nutrition, it's incomes and the ability to control your destiny in various ways. But one interesting thing that I've found is that, you know, there are so many reports from international organizations like the United Nations and the UN Development Program and stuff like that. And they always say that, look, economic growth doesn't solve all problems. Economic prosperity doesn't fix everything. So we have to look at all this great variety of indicators. But then when I read through the report and get to the statistical appendix at the end of it, I notice that economic growth correlates with almost all of these indicators. The wealthier the society, the wealthier the average individual in a society, the better off they are on average on almost all of these indicators. And it's really not strange because economic growth is our imperfect way of measuring how much we can do. And if we can do more things today than we could yesterday, create more wealth, more goods and services, more technological capacity. And if we're able to do that, we should be able to solve more problems as well. So that's what I think we should aim for if we want to improve living standards. And how do we do that? Well, I don't know. And I don't think you know, and I definitely know that our politicians don't know how to do it. Only millions and millions of people who are free to experiment with new ways of doing something tiny in their work life a little bit better today than they did yesterday. Improve methods, coming up with new technologies and goods and services only by having this great economy-wide or hopefully worldwide experiment in improving people's lives. Do they improve economic growth overall and thereby all our living standards? So basically we need economic freedom to do it.
The West is rich as a result of slavery and colonialism. How do you respond?
Well, you know, if slavery made countries rich, every country around the world would be immensely prosperous and they would have been much richer back when they had slavery than today when we've abolished it since quite a long time ago. Because every empire, every civilization, unfortunately, had slavery. And every fairly successful society also became an imperialist one and raided others at first when they had the capacity. They took control of these places. Now, when they did that, it created prosperity for a few because they stole resources. They stole people from others, but their loss was somebody else's gain. It was a static economy that didn't create any kind of wealth for others. And that's the same thing in Western countries that did engaged in the same kind of colonialism and slavery. It made small groups wealthier, but it made others poorer. The one thing that changed it all and suddenly changed the course of world history was that some 200 years ago, roughly around the same time that we began to abolish slavery in the Western world, did we begin to create institutions that made the world safe for private property, for business, for innovation, for trade around the world. And then suddenly it's not a zero-sum game anymore. Then it's a positive-sum game because you have to create something for others in order to enrich yourself. And that's the moment in time when we got tremendously rich, as Deirdre McCloskey says in her back-of-the-envelope calculation, at least 3,000% richer than we were back in that day. So, I mean, we've all had slavery and colonialism, and it made just a few robbers rich, but it made the rest of us poorer. Only when we began with capitalism did we grow rich.
On page 101, you have a discussion about the excellent store, IKEA. The basic attitude is widespread. Only manual work is real, and nothing is created by the person who invents the business idea, risks money, organizes the work, and finds new markets. What is it about the shortcoming of this socialist idea that all the value is created by the laborers and the non-laborers, the bourgeoisie, are the parasites who steal our surplus value?
Yeah, that's a great question. This is kind of the cartoon book theory of economics. Only the kind of jobs that look like you're actually doing something with your hands or exert lots of efforts and you're sweating. Only those kinds of jobs really do add value. But, you know, there's a, it's all about transforming something of less value into something of more value. And how do you do that? Well, it's not necessarily by, with this kind of manual labor. It's what creates even more value is organizing this kind of labor with better methods, with a sharper division of labor, with access to new ideas, better management, more better technology, access to other markets, and marketing it to other markets. All of that is pretty hard work as well, which you notice the moment businesses leave a town, right? Then you suddenly have a rust belt over there. You have the same number of people and they can exert exactly the same kind of effort. But if it's not organized in a productive way, it won't add any value. And that's why when people say that, look, owners of capital and the capitalists, they don't add anything. Well, look at what happens when you don't have them. The thing is, taking risks, trying to come up with better methods, that's the most difficult task there is, trying to come up with the successful products and services that people are interested in. It's not easy. And when you do that, you take a risk. Who will bear the burden of that? Of course, you can start an entirely worker-owned cooperative. That's a great part of capitalism as well. But then you bear that burden of the risk and the time as well before you get a revenue. How many are interested in working hard for a business and wait to be paid until you the business start to sell or until it makes a profit? I don't think many would. And that's why workers, when they are free to move, they move to for-profit capitalist businesses. You know, it might take 10 years until a business makes a profit. Sometimes they never make a profit. How many would be interested in working in that kind of business then?
How is it that the system called capitalism can benefit non-capitalists or consumers and employees?
Yeah, it sounds strange, but it's actually the greatest benefit. You know, we're talking so much about, look, the profits of the super rich. Why should they have it all? Well, how did they make a profit? It depends. Some might have stolen it and some probably got it through political contacts. And that's bad. And we're opposed to that. But if they got it on a free market, they only got rich by enriching others. So if a business that starts producing smartphones or hats make a profit, it's only because they first paid their workers. The workers, they must have their wage, even if they don't get it, even if they don't sell any hats or smartphones. But then also they have to produce something that customers like, hats and smartphones that are better than the competition at a better price. Then they also have to pay all their suppliers, and they also have to pay their lenders. If they do all of these things, if they make all of these groups happy, the customers, the workers, the suppliers, the lenders, which might be us when we save our retirement funds on the stock market, only if they make all of these groups happy and satisfied and get something left over, that's the profit, which will obviously be heavily taxed as well. So it means that the bigger your profit, the greater the service you have already done to all of these others, raising their purchasing power and giving them new opportunities and goods of and services that weren't there before.
On page 108, you mention the fallacy that under capitalism, the rich stay rich and the poor stay poor. How can we go about falsifying this claim that in a free market, the rich stay rich and the poor stay poor?
Well, I think you have to do it on a theoretical level and an empirical one. And it, I think it depends on whom you talk to when you talk about this. Sometimes it's useful to start with the empirical case. How have we been able to reduce poverty around the world? It started in a few countries back in, even in the 18th century, Great Britain and the Netherlands and then North America. It started in a few places where we actually, before that, extreme poverty even in those countries were higher than they are in sub-Saharan Africa today. Then in the 19th century, it began to happen in Scandinavia and in Western Europe. Then we began to reduce poverty in certain countries after the Second World War, South Korea, Taiwan, Japan. And now, in the 1980s and 90s, it's starting to happen in China, in India, in Indonesia, in Bangladesh, and so on. Right now, 130,000 people are being lifted out of extreme poverty every day. Every day we sit here and talk about how bad capitalism is, 130,000 people are lifted out of extreme poverty. Why did it happen? What's the common denominator between the timing of extreme poverty and the institutions? Well, it is that that happens to be almost the precise moment that these countries turn towards more of free markets and free trade. The moment that started happening, poverty began to decline in these places. So that's the empirical case. And then we have to investigate why that is the case. And the simple reason is that poverty doesn't need an explanation. Why are some people poor? That's the wrong question. We were all poor. The question is, how did some people start to get rich in certain places? And that's only by creating more wealth. That's the only way in which we started to get out of poverty. And that means higher productivity, being able to produce more wealth. And you do that with better technology, with better management and organization of your labor, and with fierce competition so that you upgrade your productivity constantly in your business. And all of that takes free markets. And when we can produce more, we can also earn more because we can become more valuable economically in the eyes of others. And then obviously everyone who has a business and all those workers have to work desperately hard to make sure that the goods and services and technologies that they produce come down in price so that it's accessible to more people and thereby raising purchasing power for even larger groups.
On page 119, you say capitalism is a profit and loss system. What are the implications of this?
That's an important implication because a profit system, yes, we're all looking for profit on the market. That's the way to go about things. But if you made a profit automatically, there's something wrong. It probably means that you have political protection. You have tariff protection or you have bailouts and you have friends in high places. And that often happens, unfortunately, when the government gets involved in the economy and starts to pick winners, starts to invest in active industrial policy, then suddenly some people with friends in high places, they can make a profit without the risk of a loss. It seems like when people in some places reach a certain level, gravity shifts and you can only fall upwards and you're constantly protected. Profit is what we're seeking, but the loss is an equally important signal. Because the profit is a sign you're doing something right, keep on doing it, and let's attract more competitors to this place. But losses are equally important because it tells you you're doing something wrong. try to improve on this or move to another sphere of the another sector of the economy. And unless that exists, we don't get this constant turnover, the creative destruction, whereby we constantly transfer our capital and our time, our labor into other and more productive places.
Final question. Thank you so much for your time. We might say that if I want wages to increase, what I do is I lobby the state to increase the minimum wage or, you know, have something like unions. However, one, that's extremely time consuming and you can only really indirectly affect those things as opposed to directly affect them. If you're talking to the working masses who are very upset that AOC and Bernie haven't delivered them the higher wages that they want, what can I as an individual employee do today or within the near future to increase my demand on the labor market and get a higher wage?
Yeah, that's a much better question to ask, because if you just raise your wage without having improved your productivity, without being able to produce more, it might just mean that you have a very well-paying wage for a very short time, because we will see a loss of jobs. And this is the problem always when we just increase minimum wages rather than trying to improve the contribution of workers to productivity and to economic value. So the real question is, how can we be of more benefit to others? How can we increase our productivity? And you can do that in various ways, better access to technology, but you can also do it by better access to human capital, to education, to retrain yourself, learning new skills and constantly updating your skills to the demands of the labor market, and thereby also looking for other opportunities in other places. So starting to bargain and try to come up with better wages and better positions, not from a position of having political protection, but from a position of strength, because you actually contribute this kind of value to others. This is the only way in which we have had lasting income growth in economic history. The fact that we also become more valuable by being able to do more things. So it doesn't start with the national economy. It starts at home with ourselves, thinking about how can we do more and better things for others.
So it's not about making the capitalist a nicer person. It's about making sure we have an environment where capitalists are competing for us to pay the wage. Because I see this as very different. Cenk Uygur will say things like, well, you think these people are just going to do it out of the kindness of their heart? No way, you need the state, which seems like the false dichotomy. So your argument is not that, well, the capitalists are actually really nice. They're just as self-interested as all the consumers who shop at their stores, but it's this competitive aspect. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That's exactly the point. I mean, why is it that businesses suddenly started paying twice as much to workers in places like Bangladesh and Cambodia in their export sectors? It's not that those greedy capitalists suddenly became twice as kind and did it out of the kindness of their heart. It was the case that the economy grew more productive, more access to technology, to capital and to markets in other places. So every single worker could produce more and so became more valuable to the employer. And if it's a really mean employer, he would say, you still won't get a raise. In that case, they have options. They can go elsewhere because they are now worth more. They can produce more value and they're therefore more valuable to others. And thereby, they can continue to climb and continue to get income progress. So it's not, you're absolutely right. It's a false dichotomy that it's the state or it's the kindness of their heart. It's what you bring to the table, not what the employer or government brings to the table.
The book is The Capitalist Manifesto, Why the Global Free Market Will Save the World. Find the book in the link in the description below. Mr. Norberg, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Keith. It was a pleasure.